Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 199 of Registry Matters. Larry, we should just dive right in, man. Are you ready to hit this? Because we got this. What else are we doing tonight that's exciting?
We're going to be doing a patron extra for the people who support us. And hopefully we don't run off too many of our patrons. But we're going to be talking about the United States economy.
Oh, and whether are you an economist?
Whether it's in good condition or whether it's in deplorable condition. There's all these varying views. So we're going to talk about the economy and do a deep dive.
Awesome. What are we going to do on the main feed for the regular folks?
Well, we're going to read some letters that were sent to us from people behind the walls and a couple from people who listen to us electronically. And we're going to talk about a case from a couple years ago from the United States Supreme Court. And it should be a very interesting episode, to say the least.
I am looking forward to it. I did interrupt. I did say, how are you? And then jump right into stuff. So how are you?
I'm doing awesome. I'm looking forward to a week from now. We're going to decide a week from now whether Halloween is Saturday or Sunday.
I'm pretty sure. Like, when did this become a thing? In my brain, Larry, it was always on the 31st. And it was also dark outside because we moved the time zones like in 2000, not the time zones, daylight savings time to when like 05, I think. But hasn't it always been on Sunday and this Saturday thing is kind of new?
I suppose so, but it seems like there's people that have written to us saying that they're going to be ordered to stay home both nights because it may be celebrated on Saturday night and the authorities are not sure. So they're going to just to be on the safe side, make sure folks are not out or doing things they might be tempted to grab a child that's trick-or-treating.
And even before my little visit with the Georgia Department of Corrections, I just remember I remember it just being on Sunday. But the other thing that's always been weird to me is trunk or treat. Like, man, when I was a kid, we just got our little bags and we started scouring the neighborhood and we went and collected candy and came home with candy. We didn't have some, I don't know, structured doing it in the square of the town or anything like that. We just went out and went on our own.
I agree. I think that kind of destroys the spirit of trick-or-treating and figuring out which house to go to and judging by the decorations and the affluence of the neighborhood and what you've heard from other trick-or-treaters to just go to a central location and scoop up candy doesn't seem to be very much fun. You know, it's kind of like, to me, I enjoy buying Scout cookies from the girls, but when the adults are all there selling the cookies and there's no girls anywhere to be seen, I know it still technically goes to the Scouts, but I kind of like the interaction with a shy girl saying, hey, would you like to buy some Scout cookies? And I say, well, tell me about those cookies. And I like to see if they've actually been coached in what to say, if they can think on their feet. And like, it's no fun for someone who's not a Girl Scout to be selling cookies. So I never buy them unless there's girls selling them.
All right, then. Okay, so let's move on. Did you did say what we were doing tonight on the main feed? Yes, you did. So we can begin, yes?
I think we can.
Excellent. So we have an article, a typed letter. Larry, this is another thing. I never had any access to any sort of like mass production of text. Like, I type really fast, and I always had to write. It was a very disturbing interaction that I had. But, so this individual has typed us a little letter. It says, Dear Larry and Andy, hello, guys. It's Doug again from Central Michigan Correctional of the Michigan Department of Corrections. Central Michigan, sorry. Doug again from Central Michigan Correctional. That doesn't even make any sense the way that's worded. All right, anyway. He's from the Michigan Department of Corrections. I wish I was writing you concerning something other than this. I'm very troubled over the poor soul you featured through his listener question in episode 194 recorded on 9/18. In this transcript, his question appeared at the time 11/28 and concern the facts that he is an inmate in the Luther Luckett Correctional Complex in LaGrange, Kentucky, and more importantly, the fact that he was attacked and raped by another inmate. I am writing in hopes you could get the following information to him and everybody else if possible. There is an organization out there called Just Detention International, JDI, that I hope he and anybody else who has ever went through this has enough courage to contact. At this facility, we have their contact information posted in every housing unit. The following is their contact information and description of services offered as listed in Prisoner Activist Resource Center 21 Resource Directory. Now, that would be 2021 Resource Directory. And I'll quickly give the address so that it ends up in the transcript. Just Detention International, Miss Cynthia Totten, T-O-T-T-E-N, Esquire, and it lists her bar number of 199-266. That's 3325 Wilshire Boulevard, Suite 340, Los Angeles, California, 90010. Yeah, if you have any problems like that, first of all, there's PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and then, of course, follow that information. This stuff should not happen to you while you're locked up.
It's awesome that Douglas wrote this to us, and the best way we can share the information is through this podcast. Unfortunately, very few prisoners get it, but since I am the publisher of the Narsal Digest newsletter, we may run this resource in there because it's such a significant thing, traumatic and horrible, and so we may thank you, Doug, for sending this.
And also, Larry, if anybody puts like a piece of candy on your bed when you get locked up, don't eat it. Don't take it. Just leave it there.
Tell me about that. I'm not familiar with that.
They're going to come collect that debt. So you want to give them that candy bar back.
Well, wouldn't you
Moving
be able to pay
right
for
along,
it?
Larry. Huh?
Wouldn't you be able to pay them the economic value of the bar?
Yeah, you're going to pay for it. I don't think it's going to be any sort of economic value. You're not going to trade a stamp for it or something like that. You're going to... Anywho. All right, moving on, Larry. Dear Larry and Andy, my name is Michael, and I am a prisoner in Wisconsin. However, in 30 days, I will be released and sent to Maryland through Interstate Compact. On several occasions, you described Maryland as being pure as the wind-driven snow. Why do you describe it this way? Are you implying that it's a great state for PFRs, or are you being facetious? I don't know if your description means I'm headed for a good state or a dangerous trap. That being said, I know that you've been sending rules and regulations for various states from the Class Kids Foundation website. If possible, could you send me that information for Maryland? I'm enclosing 15 stamps to help defray any expenses. When released, I plan to become a subscriber to your podcast. Currently, my friend Sean lets me read the transcripts he receives, but when I just subscribed, I'd like to consider being a patron. What are the differences between just subscribing and being a patron? What are the different patronage levels? Thank you in advance for all the information and answers I've requested. I appreciate all the time you guys spent on the podcast, Michael. Thank you very much, Michael. So I'll quickly describe. We don't really have anything different as far as the different levels. I'll reveal the man behind the curtain. If you subscribe at $1, you get the same stuff as you do if you subscribe at the $1,400 a month level, the stimulus check level. However, people find that the information provided is more valuable than others, but we wanted to make it available to everybody because a lot of our people have very severe financial hardships. So people come in at all different levels, but you can get away with just doing $1. But Larry, I'll let you describe the subscriber side of it versus the Patreon side.
Well, that's easily described. Most people who listen to us either on our patron distribution or through YouTube or all the different ways they listen to us, they have very little interest in the transcript. The only time they're interested in the transcript, we've got a few listeners that will go back and use the transcript so they can put some critical comment in YouTube that's been said.
But that has happened recently, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has on this last week. If we have time, we may get to that. But yeah, that's really only the difference. And we realize that most prisoners who are behind the walls are not able to listen. So we wanted to provide content. So this transcript is something different for people who cannot listen to us. And it's actually quite a costly production. There's labor going into making the transcript accurate from the auto-transcribe, and then the printing and the postage and the envelopes and the distribution. But FYP Education is committed to making information available. The people who are behind the walls are going to be outside the walls at some point, most of them, the overwhelming majority of them. And these are questions that arise all the time, and we are helping you to know what you're looking at when you get out.
Back to his questions. What did he ask? First of all, is Maryland pure as the wind-driven snow and the best state to transfer your supervision to?
It is not, but he's leaving a state that's not all that fantastic either. Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is that state that sends you the bill for the $100 and tells you that you need to continue to keep your registration current.
Yes, yes.
While you're no longer living there. I'm not aware of any other state that does that. Now, there are other states that will keep you on the website, but they're not telling you that you must report to them and pay them money. But Wisconsin does that. Maryland, that's a joke. The executive director of NARSL and I, when we became friends, she was relatively a novice at advocacy. And we were talking about the treatment as it exists in most paradigms that exist out there. And I told her, well, in general, this is a collaborative fishing expedition. They use what they can get you to confess to a treatment, and then they turn around and revoke you or violate you in some way, maybe tightening your restrictions on supervision. I said, I'm just not fond of that type of treatment. I'm a very big proponent of real treatment. And she says, well, we don't do it that way in Maryland. I said, well, I hate to tell you, you actually do. Yeah, Maryland is not. I'm sure that there might be some jurisdictions within the 23 counties of Maryland that try to do a better job. But it's not pure as the wind-driven snow. But it is a very good state overall. They have the benefit of two state Supreme Court decisions, which I was peripherally involved in, the strategy and the litigation. And their souped-up version that they enacted in 2010 cannot be applied retroactively. So therefore, if he happens to have an old offense and he's been in Wisconsin for a very long time, he might very well find himself under the old registration scheme in Maryland, which would be, in many instances, only 10 years. But depending on those factors, and I'm not going to try to analyze them here, Maryland's not a bad state. The disadvantage he has, he's just on interstate compact. And you remember, you have the conditions from Wisconsin that are on your supervision. And then you have the conditions that Maryland want to add, as long as they're consistent with what they put on PFRs. And you have to comply with both sets of supervision conditions. And both violations, whether it's from a Wisconsin condition or a Maryland condition, can get you in deep trouble and revoked. And due process is hard to come by, because even though you're entitled to a probable cause hearing, those are very difficult to arrange. And people end up just signing their waivers and going back, and then they end up in the state where they might not have even had to go back to had they insisted on a probable cause hearing. We've done a couple of episodes on that.
Yes, we have. All right. And so let's be clear. I know that we'll have to revisit this because somebody will start listening on the next episode and they didn't hear this. When you say pure as the wind-driven snow, are you being serious or are you being facetious or facetious?
I'm being a little bit facetious. It's not a bad state overall. They don't charge you registration fees. I think they might charge supervision fees as part of their supervision regimen for your punishment. But it's not really all that bad to Maryland comparatively. There's no state I would say is ideal and perfect, but Maryland is not a bad place to go. So he's not going from a great state to a horrible state. He's going from a pretty bad state to a much better state. Maryland actually doesn't even have any residency restrictions as far as in the law, but it could be that the supervising authorities may impose them while you're under supervision. So that's something he's going to have to find out when he gets there.
And the class kid stuff, the rules and regulations, will you be able to send that? Will that be able to get sent to him about the state in Maryland?
Absolutely. We have been doing that. People have actually been requesting those. And I think even though some people say we shouldn't do it because it promotes the class foundation, which they're not actually in alignment with our views, the information they have is largely accurate. It comes directly from the state and it gets updated annually. And I would much prefer to be able to punt to the class foundation if something's wrong, and then FYP Education doesn't own that. We give them full credit. This is their information from their website. And if you rely on it, your beef is with class, not with FYP.
Fair enough. And how big is the staff at FYP now?
Oh, it's enormous. We've got
research. Because I can't keep up with it. That's why
we're just the tip of the iceberg. We've got a research department. We've got writers of content.
Yeah, we've got video production and audio production staff.
So I mean, we're going to soon overtake the EIB network in terms of the number of people we employ.
Of course.
Now, right, well, everybody who doesn't know, EIB is the Excellence in Broadcasting Network that Rush Limbaugh was the originator of.
Yes. And all right, well, then let's move on to a question from one of our patrons sent this in. This came from Patrick. Can a federal probation officer based on sex offender loitering zoning laws in Georgia prohibit you from going to church? I'm not a, I guess loitering. Loitering is a specific term. What can you give me offhand the legal definition of loitering?
I can't, but he had thrown it into question. And it's generally, as a general rule, to be hanging out with no purpose. If you're like just meandering, and if you're patronizing a business, if you're sitting at McDonald's and you're consuming your meal, you're not loitering. But on the other hand, if you stay at McDonald's for hours on end because there's a playground and you're not conducting any legitimate business, then that could transfer from being a patron to loitering. And he put all that in his question, and he did a very diligent amount of research, excellent research. And he's got some of the best arguments that anybody could make, and he really needs an attorney. But can they stop him from going to church? Yes. You remember what we say about can they do it?
They can do it until they're told to stop.
That is correct. Now, in some circumstances, they might be able, remember, narrow tailoring to the individual offender is the key. If a person had been in a church, I'm trying to figure out how you would narrowly tailor a condition that would be appropriate. If they had committed their offense at a church, I think any probation department that wanted to severely restrict physical presence in church would be on fairly solid ground to do that. And particularly if they did that in a setting where they might have had a leadership role. They violated trust and so forth. But if it, in a general situation, telling a person they cannot exercise their First Amendment, I believe that's First Amendment, separation, freedom for religion and separation of church right. and state, I believe that would be a very serious violation. And he could possibly seek redress through a competent attorney in the state of Georgia, because the federal probation office, I think, is over the top unless his offense merits that type of restriction on an individual basis, not because they just plucked us out of the Georgia. There is something in the Georgia registration statute that prohibits a PFR from loitering, but loitering is defined, and they refer to the other section of Georgia statute that defines what loitering is, and being there for a legitimate purpose is not loitering.
If we were to overlay, and this is me and my non-legal mind, if we were to overlay Packingham, the premise behind that was the person went onto Facebook and he posted a religious message because he didn't get a ticket, whatever, speeding ticket. And he said, praise the Lord. Thank you, Jesus. Something along those lines. I would imagine that that would be some kind of referenceable material for you going to church that the Supreme Court said, nah, you can't do it for that reason. So this seems to be like at least in the same ballpark.
Correct. They're going to have to provide him. If there's no basis for the prohibition of going to church, it just won't stand. But if they can come up with something related to you that somewhat justifies it, then they're going to have to provide you an ample alternative means to worship, because they just cannot extinguish your right to worship.
But that doesn't apply in the opposite direction. Go ahead, Larry.
But what that adequate alternative method would be subject to interpretation. If they tell you that you can listen to the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, I don't know if that would qualify as an adequate suitable alternative, you know, ample other alternate means. But if they say you can go to a small church that doesn't have a daycare and your offense involved a hands-on with a child, that might withstand scrutiny possibly. I don't know. All this stuff has not been fully developed in the litigation. Some things we just don't know the answer to.
But in Georgia, they were going to challenge... They were going to go on almost like a slander campaign against a church that kicked one of our people out. But a church can deny you access, but probation, the government can't deny you from going to church just carte blanche.
That is correct. Now, that's what's really puzzled me. I have great difficulty understanding why you want to be where the business or the entity doesn't want you. And I know people are going to throw eggs at me because there have to be exceptions to where it would be someplace like the Capitol. I don't care if the people in the Capitol want me or not. I want to be there. That's not the analogy I'm making. But if I'm going to spend my hard-earned dollars and mine, unlike the people on the other side of this microphone that just rain from the sky, I have to I have to work for mine. That was supposed to be funny. But I don't want to go spend my money in a business that doesn't want me. By the same token, I would say the same thing about a church. If a church tells me, we do not want your kind here, why would you want to be there? Now, the first response would be, I've got friends there. I've been a member of that church. My family's been there for decades. That would be their first response. But that's still, that doesn't matter to me. If the congregation doesn't welcome you, part of the worship experience is diminished. And I don't know why you would want to be there. But people insist that, no, they actually don't. They don't have to let you in.
Totally. All right. Well, then let's move along. And this is from, I forget the name of the person that sent this one in. But it's to the Narsal Legal Corner. It says, I am currently civilly confined in New York State PFR Management and Treatment Act Program. It's Sex Offenders Management and Treatment Act Program. If, when I am released unconditionally with a complete discharge from civil management, I would like to travel to North Carolina to stay and visit with friends in that area, then go to Kentucky and then Ohio to see family in those states for an extended stay. Most likely, I would then come back to New York State to live. My question is a general one that has relevance to a wide number of PFRs. Once I've registered in a particular state and then move to another state and register there, do I have to continue with registration on the registry on the state I've moved out of and no longer reside in? Upon moving to the third state, am I then required to keep up registration on multiple states, or is it just the one that I currently reside in? Respectfully, and I still can't read the name. It's written in cursive, and I don't want to put it up on the screen. So do you have to keep registering in the state that you've come from?
It is from Mark, and this is exactly, folks, listen to that question. That is exactly the type of question we love to answer, because it's not specific to your case necessarily.
Sure.
We don't have to do in-depth legal research to try to figure out the answer and risk being wrong. And we know enough from our life experience to answer this as a general rule. As a general rule, when you go to another state, you will have to register. The previous state, your obligations to them will terminate. It's like, think of it when you take your vehicle. When you move your vehicle from North Carolina and you take that vehicle to Arizona and you decide that you're going to register the vehicle in Arizona, North Carolina will cease charging your registration fee and they will quit sending you a notice to update. That's the same thing as a general rule that happens when you're on the sexual offender registry in one of our wonderful 50 states. When you move from one state to another state, your obligation ceases because it's a civil regulatory scheme that applies to you. You're no longer there to be regulated. Now, that does not mean that it will take you off the website, but a website is a historical record of what was. So they may leave you on the website, and we'll get into why that can be dangerous later in my answer, but they may leave you on the website, but generally they do not require you to continue to communicate with them. The exception being, one exception that we know emphatically is Wisconsin. If you're convicted in Wisconsin and you leave Wisconsin, they will tell you that you're obligated to continue to report to them and pay the $100. And when I say report, not physically in person, but to send in their form and verify your information. I happen to believe that's unconstitutional, but it's constitutional until the court says it isn't. So that would be the exception. Now, what I don't know about Wisconsin is if their conviction is from another state and you move into Wisconsin and you have a registration obligation and then you cease to live there and you connect yourself with another registry, if Wisconsin says we continue to need to collect our $100, I don't know the answer to that. So I know we've got dozens of Wisconsin people. So that would be one I would be delighted to know. But in terms of how this can harm you, I said I was going to get back to that. It can harm you in the aspect that you may be in a state where you can be discharged from registration. So say you visited Florida or one of the several states that never remove you from the website. So you're in a state that terminates your obligation lawfully through a petition process, and you time out one of the two, and your registration obligation ceases. You're still on the website in Florida or Nevada, or one of those states that never removes you from the website. You're not having to send any form or any money, but there's a likeness of you and your offense description. There's a lot of stuff on the internet that will linger forever, and you will still be hampered by the fact that you were registered So try not to go to a state that never removes you from the website. I mean, that would be my advice. Do your best to avoid that.
Can you rattle off a handful of states that never take you off? Obviously, Florida.
Florida and I know, and Nevada doesn't take you off, but they both show you living out of state. But what they don't do, to my knowledge, is if you've been lawfully discharged from registration, they don't show that. They'll just show the last address that you were registered and was reported them. So when you leave Florida and you connect with the registry authorities in New Mexico, New Mexico will communicate that address to Florida, and they'll show that you're living out of state at that address. As far as I know, they don't continue to update that. You know, I haven't had any personal experience, but I have been told that address shown in Florida is very old by a person who actually does live here that has a Florida conviction. So I don't know that they continue to update it. But if the registration obligation were to end in New Mexico, guess what? You're still on the Florida website, and people say, I'm still being forced to register. No, you're not being forced to register. They're carrying a historical record of your registration.
There's somebody in chat saying that he was in North Carolina, has since left, and then he's still listed on the website. I hadn't heard of North Carolina being one of those states that when you leave there, you get to stick around and be memorialized, so to speak.
I think there are a lot more states doing it than we realize. I think our state does it. Okay. I think it's hit or miss with our state. I've heard people say that they're still on the website, and I've heard people say they took me off. So I don't know. I don't know how that works, but it's very difficult for you to know that. I mean, if you call them, say, I'm thinking about visiting you people, and I'm wondering if I visit you people, if you're going to take me, if you people are going to take me off the registry, off your website when I leave, and they're going to say, that's a good idea. Maybe we should change the law to make sure that'll discourage you people from visiting us. I mean, but you got to be careful.
That's kind of my question. Is that in statute that these places leave it on, or is it just a clerical oversight that you left and nobody crossed the right T and dotted the right I to have you then removed?
No, I don't think the statute addresses it either way. I think it's just a practice that's arisen. I don't think there's anything in the statute of Florida that says they shall be carried on the website forever. And I don't think there's any such thing in New Mexico statute nor in North Carolina. It's just the practice that's developed. Now, the theory goes that they're doing it to get the extra tracking money from the SMART office in Washington, D.C. But I don't believe that theory. I do not believe that if the government pays people to do residency verifications on folks that are not there, then we're in deeper trouble than I thought.
That's interesting. And maybe that's why if you went around and checked state by state by state, maybe you would end up with the million people on the registry, but that's because somebody went and visited North Carolina for 15 days and ended up on the registry and then went home. So it's not just the 80,000 people on the registry in Florida when there's only 30 and change, whatever, that are actually registering.
Yes, that's what people misunderstand when they add up all the registrants in one state and then they do go to the next state, then they compile the grand total. The reason that's flawed from the get-go is there's a component of people that are not listed on registries in some states. They're registered but not listed publicly, so you would miss those. And then the people that are registered in more than one state, when I say registered, listed on the website in more than one state, some are actually legitimately registered in more than one state because they hop across the border to go to work or go to school. Right. And they have an obligation to register in both states. But there are so many duplicates. So you need to take all those numbers you hear and throw them straight into the garbage because they're not accurate.
And somebody else, one of our friends from Wyoming, I think it is, he visited his parents in Sarasota, Florida for 2 weeks in August. He's still on the Florida registry.
and he will be for the rest of his days unless they change that.
So. And one final question on that there, Larry. Do you then have to go visit Florida and like check in, call in, drive down there and say, yes, I still live out of state? Or is it just almost like a stagnant record, a dead record that you once visited Florida, you no longer live there and they just leave you on the website? There's nothing that you have to do actively to maintain it?
Yeah, that's what I mentioned earlier, that they will show the address as it was reported to them, but they don't continue to impose any obligations on you. When people say it's the same as registering, no, it isn't. You don't have any residency prohibition, proximity restrictions. You don't have any obligation to notify Florida before you travel. You don't have so it's not anything approximating the same thing. You don't have any. People like to say, I'm still registered. No, you're listed on the website. You're not registered. You're not complying with registration in Florida.
All right, man.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, let's move on to the next question. It says, hey, Andy and Larry, in episode 198, you were discussing parole and probation revocation hearings. In 2018, the Supreme Court heard a case in United States versus Hemond, in which Justice Alito said the case had the potential to bring down the entire federal supervised release system, but for the time being, let it stand. In that case, for those of you not familiar with it, Hemond was sentenced to 38 months in prison and 10 years of supervised release. 2.5 years after Hemond began his supervised release, he was violated with a 5-year mandatory imprisonment term, which the court ruled unconstitutional. Hemond argued that the supervised release statute, which required PFRs to serve up a lifetime on supervised release, was unconstitutional because it exceeded the statutory limits of the actual crime itself. However, since Hemond had not served more time on his supervised release than his statute required, the court threw out that argument. I wanted to get you people's opinion on those who do serve more time on supervision than the actual crime. For instance, if your crime was for 0 to 10 years, you served 10 years in prison and then were violated for supervised release violation afterwards and forced back to prison, going over the 10-year statutory maximum. What are your thoughts on that? Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, this is our main event, isn't it?
Did I jump ahead? I put something out of order then. All right. Yeah, we'll do our main event and then we'll come back to other things. That's fine.
Sure.
My bad.
Okay. All right. Well, this is the big discussion item we're going to have. And the essence of Jacob's question is that it's really very succinct. He argued that the supervised release statute, which required PFRs to serve up to lifetime on supervised release, was unconstitutional. And so that was the essence of it. And so I don't completely agree with the final part where he said the court threw out that argument. I don't read it that way. But the rest of what he said is pretty much spot on. But let's talk about the case. The case is United States versus Hemond, and that's 139 Supreme Court, 2369. 2019. The court held that by imposing a mandatory term of imprisonment after evoking supervised release based on a finding of, by preponderance of the evidence, that he had breached his conditions of supervised release, violated the Sixth Amendment's jury trial guarantee and the Fifth Amendment due process proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard for criminal cases. The court left for the lower court to determine whether the error was harmless and if not, what was the appropriate remedy? That's what this is about.
Okay. I bet you I have a whole battery of questions for you.
Well, I know you do.
I do. Now I understand what the hell is happening. All right, let me cover some background on the case then. A federal jury convicted Hemond of possessing some CP, which is punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years. The district court sentenced him to 38 months in prison and supervised release for 10 years thereafter. The court conditioned Hemond's supervised release on him committing no further crimes, submitting to periodic polygraph examinations, kabuki machine, and consenting to searches by his probation officer. It is humorous that Hemond passed several polygraphs, suggesting that he had neither viewed nor possessed any CP since his release. Yet, when Hemond's probation officer seized Hemond's cell phone, he found images of CP cached there. This alone shows that the kabuki machine is not accurate. What happened next, Larry?
Well, you can guess that they moved to revoke his supervised release. And at his revocation hearing, Hemond presented expert testimony that the material could have been put on his cell phone without his knowledge. Nevertheless, the court concluded, this is the trial court, that it was likely, more likely than not, remember that's the standard for revocation, that Hammond had knowingly possessed child pornography in violation of the condition of his conditions release. The trial court, with reservations, ordered him returned to prison for the mandatory minimum of 5 years.
Wow, 5 years. I'm guessing that Hammond appealed?
He did indeed. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit reversed the trial court, holding that the mandatory minimum feature of the sentencing revocation procedure violates the Fifth and Sixth Amendments.
How about, so what was basic argument on appeal to the Supreme Court, though?
Well, Hammond claims that the federal supervised release statute for those legal beagles, that's 18 United States Code, Section 3583, which subjects federal inmates on their release from prison to certain conditions, usually for a maximum of only 5 years. But for certain sexual offenses, the supervised release term is at least 5 years and may be for the sex offender's entire life. Under the statute, a court may revoke an individual's supervised release and return him or her to prison by preponderance of the evidence, and if the court finds that the individual violated the condition of the release. So that was what his claim was to the Supreme Court, that the whole thing was unconstitutional. Now, I think it was actually the state that appealed, because you see the title of the case is United States versus Hammond, so that means they are the ones who filed the cert petition. So they weren't happy with what the Tenth Circuit had done, so they took this up to the Supreme Court.
As I understand it, when a court revokes supervised release, it re-imprisons the individual for no longer than his remaining time of supervised release, and in any event, for no longer than 5 years with an exception for PFRs. Under subsection 3583K, a court must sentence a PFR registrant to re-imprisonment for at least 5 years when the court revoked his supervised release based on a PFR offense.
That is correct, and therein lies the problem. That subsection that came into being, I think they said in 2006, but that provision was the issue before the court, and if allowed to stand, it would permit a person to be on perpetual supervision that could be revoked without proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a fundamental constitutional right. That was really a battle of judicial ideology. The conservatives took the position that federal supervised release should be treated the same as parole or probation revocation, which does not require or provide the same level of due process, because both are forms of conditional liberty. On the other hand, supervised release, as used in the federal system, is a rehabilitative period that follows the completion of one's punishment of imprisonment. Federal parole was abolished in 1984 when the Sentencing Reform Act was passed and signed by none other than President Ronald Reagan.
What was the ultimate outcome then?
Well, the court actually agreed with the Tenth Circuit that those provisions were unconstitutional, because what you had is a mandatory, no matter how much the person had served, if they had any supervised release remaining, they were required to impose a mandatory 5 years. So say you made it through your entire period of supervised release to the final 6 months. And that was all the jurisdiction of the court left, because they gave you all the time that they had available to you. They didn't in this case, but say they did. They gave you all the time they had available to you. And then you finish that, complete that, and you, under normal circumstances, they would revoke the remainder of your term. But Congress decided that 5 years would be the minimum if you violated your supervised release if you were a PFR with this list of offenses. So the Tenth Circuit, the Supreme Court actually agreed with the Tenth Circuit, and they remanded the case back to them to address whether the issue could be resolved by requiring that subsection 3583K revocation hearings be conducted before a jury or using the standard burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, because the person is in essence getting a new sentence. That the liberal
That's what
point
I was just
going
to ask you. Why didn't they ask him if he had new charges? Why didn't they just, hey, look, we're charging you for a new crime?
That was actually in the decision. The pointy heads on the court pointed that out, you know, that he could have actually the government. But see, that requires a more complicated process and a higher burden of proof. And that's exactly what they said is, hey, you know, if he was such a bad guy, they could have charged him with, because these 13 of the 53 images were thought to be for sure knowingly in his possession. They might not have been able to prove the other 40, but they said, gee, if you can obtain a life sentence and impose because potentially the 5 years is the minimum under that section, subsection 3583K. They said, why not? You would never need to ever convict anybody of anything. You could just simply lock them up. So that's where the plurality, I have trouble saying that, of the court. Four joined by one of the liberals. He agreed with the outcome, but he didn't necessarily agree with all their reasoning. But he anyway, it turned out that it was basically an ideological divide. And so I think you were going to ask that question, but I've already beat you to it.
Well, yeah, that too. I wanted to ask you the question, though, about, because I know that you love it when I actually always try to do, is this a blue or red thing? Which justices took which positions in this case? Well,
in this case, it almost was, and often it is. I know that our audience really gets trepidated when I do that, though, because sometimes the conservative judges that are appointed by conservative presidents are spectacular. Scalia would be an example of being spectacular on the Confrontation Clause. You didn't have a better friend on confrontation. But Scalia wasn't right on everything when it came to criminal justice. So they'll latch on to one thing that a justice says in one particular case, and they don't look at the totality. Generally, the liberal judges are more likely to be sympathetic to these arguments of people who are behind bars and to protect them from the law enforcement apparatus. But you are correct. I hate for us to frame things that way. But in reality, it does more often than not that the conservative justice side with the law enforcement apparatus. In this instance, the dissenters were all conservative judges who argued that the sky would fall because of what the liberals had done, and they were joined by Justice Gorsuch. So he's perceived to be a conservative appointed by Trump. But the way it aligned was Justice Alito, who was joined by Justice Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice John Roberts, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh. They wrote the dissenting opinion that said that that proof beyond a reasonable doubt are not constitutionally required for supervised release revocation proceedings, and that to suggest otherwise has, quote, serious implications. So if you like that type of ruling, then I'm fine with it. But typically, you're going to get this alignment on criminal justice stuff, and this is typically the way it unfolds, but not an absolute. You know, we got Gorsuch. So without Gorsuch, it would have gone the other way. I mean, I don't know what the outcome would have been, but he actually was on the right side of this.
I got you. Is there anything else on this before we move on? That's super neat. So let me try and kick back and we'll see. If you got a 10-year sentence and after 8 years you were released on parole or probation, whatever, and you end up with some kind of revocation, and they're going to then hit you with 5 years, you are now essentially doing 13 years, and that would be against what the judge initially sentenced you to, the 10 years. That's the unconstitutional part?
That is correct. And that's what he's, in essence, asking. He's wanting to know if this can be used for people whose supervision period has exceeded the maximum jurisdiction of the court. And I believe it can, but again, he would need to consult with a legal professional for particularized legal advice, but I believe it can. But see, they've skirted that, and they mentioned that in this long opinion. They mentioned that legislatures and Congress have been very creative in finding sentencing schemes that didn't exist back in colonial times, you know, with the community supervision for life, the CSL as it's called. That didn't exist in colonial times. Probation didn't even exist in colonial times. So it's like, you know, all this stuff is relatively novel, and we don't.
And that's
have
because
the
there's a mandatory minimum for this thing.
Well, for violating supervised release, normally it would be like they said you would be subject to the remainder of your supervised release, but they start the clock all over for a PFR. They give you a mandatory 5 years despite what you'd already done, and the 5 years could overlap the end of what would have been the end of your sentence, and that's what this is about, as I understood it.
Okay. So the two people that we know recently, one of them is going to just finish out their sentence, I think, or they're dropping the remaining year, right?
Yes.
He has 3 years
yes.
left, he's getting two, and they're going to call it quits when he's done. The other person has like 7 years, and he's going to do two, so he's still going to have five left. These two things don't fall into that category because they're not going to exceed their original sentence.
That is correct. But in the case of, like, in my state, we have this period of parole, which is really nothing more than supervised release because you serve all your time. And then you have a 5 to 20. So like, for example, child solicitation by electronic communications device is an offense that only carries a sentence of no more than 3 years. But yet you can end up serving, if you violate your parole period, you could end up serving much longer than that. A lot of litigation can unfold based on this case out of the 10th Circuit. And I think, in fact, on my listserv here in New Mexico, I've seen people saying, hey, we need to litigate this because you can end up serving more time than what the crime carried to start with.
Interesting. Okay. Well, now that I took everything out of order, now I got to figure out where we got to go next.
We got to go back to where we were supposed to be.
I know. And yes, I don't have a name on this person, but I'm going to wing it, Larry. I am a military convicted PFR out on supervised release. Do you think that's where we're supposed to be?
So, well, that we've already, I think we've done this one. I think this is just an extended version of it, but let's see what it is.
Okay. I'm having an issue with my federal probation officers missing. Oh yeah, that's probably that one. Okay. Yeah. So that's like supporting stuff, man. I'm so confused about what's going on.
Yeah. You've got old timers tonight.
Holy crap, man. I have no idea what's going on. I don't know what I posted that one as question two, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what question two from Jacob is, Larry. I have no idea what this one is. Hold on. I'm going to go find this question.
So, well, I'll just do some monologuing while you're getting question two. But in terms of that issue, that was a great question for sure. And I would like to see the litigation, and I expect to see more litigation on that as time unfolds, and we'll see what the courts do, because there is a limit to how much a person can be punished for the same crime.
All right. Larry, I don't have a question too, man. I don't know what you put in there as question two from Jacob.
You don't have a question for Jacob?
Well, I don't see it. Yeah, you get to read it then.
Well, I don't have it up, but I will find it. I know I wasn't hallucinating.
Then while you locate this, I'm going to read something from one of our people. It says, Andy, thank you for discussing the article about Tennessee looking into registry changes that I dropped into Discord story ideas. Tell Larry how disappointing his reaction was to me. I jest, but he's probably true. I hope they might do something bipartisan, but as we know in this political age, that ain't gonna happen. I promise to follow up with any additional news I hear on this one. He also had a comment in there that the patrons, Larry, I didn't tell you this, but the patrons didn't hear the Who's That Speaker last week because editing podcasts is complicated and there's another track and I forgot to bring in the other track. Sorry. And then lastly, congrats on your Noshella World and thank you very much. I received an award at the conference. So thank you. Did you find what you needed to find?
We actually have done that one also. So, yes, that was a great comment. And what I would say to him is I realize it disappointed people. But let's have a little, since we got a little extra time, we didn't take all the time we normally do on, we can talk about the political reality. The reason why I made that comment, and I always hope I'm wrong when I make these comments, and I freely come back and say I was wrong when that happens. But what we're looking at is Tennessee is within the Sixth Circuit, so the Doe's versus Snyder decision is binding on them. But that doesn't mean it happens automatically. It means that cases have to be litigated and it has to be proven that the Tennessee registry is enough similarities. There are enough similarities that the Doe versus Snyder would merit a similar outcome. And I think that article said there were like 30 cases pending. Well, I think the article also said, as I recall, that the legislature was considering changes because of what the court might do. Well, there's where my expertise comes in. I can understand and explain politics. So what you have is a federal judiciary. The Sixth Circuit is a federal circuit court. They have Article III lifetime tenure, and they cannot be retaliated against. You don't get a Judge Persky in the federal court system. And that's for those who don't remember, that was the judge that got recalled that sentenced the Stanford swimmer to too lenient of a sentence. You don't get Judge Persky in the federal system. So what you would have would be people, you're thinking that people who are elected by the citizens of Tennessee, they're going to make life better for PFRs because of what a court might do. They haven't done it yet, but they may do it. That is really far-fetched. I hope it happens, but the likelihood of that happening is very slim because I would like to be running against you if you did do something to make life better for PFRs, and your cited reason was the court might do something. Don't you, can you see the what the ads would look like? You remember the ones we played about the New Mexico congressional race? We yes. played the ad. That's exactly what the ad would look like. They would say that representative or senator such and such made life better for sex offenders on pure speculation of what a court might do. And therefore, that makes that very unlikely.
This is, I think, where we were going to talk about the, there was a woman at the conference that really got a little overwrought with her son is in civil commitment, and she started really bashing on politicians and saying that all they're interested in is getting reelected and so forth. We were going to exchange some comments about not what she did, but the things that she said, and we were going to talk about the potential. There's a different economy for politics than there are for like a job.
Well, not significantly different. I mean, so
I mean, they work for money, but their currency is votes, right?
Yes, yes.
So then they have to do to some degree what the people in their district want, whether that's county, state, whatever. They're going to do what those people want them to do, or else they will not be doing that anymore.
That is correct. And that's what really puzzles me about the misunderstanding and lack of fully understanding about our democratic process. When you've referred to someone as a representative, they are speaking for you, not against you. And they are supposed to represent the views of the people that sent them there. To be irate and furious at them that they are for the registry when that's where the people are, is really short-sighted, because that's where the people are. And what are they supposed to do? Flip the middle finger and say, despite you're for this, to hell with you people? I mean, we've not moved the dial on where the people are. And when we move the dial on where the people are, the political dial will move itself, just like it did on same-sex marriage. When it all of a sudden became that's where the people are, that they were okay with it, and they supported it, all of a sudden, you notice how magically politicians, liberal and conservative, aligned themselves. I mean, it was very quick. But
I'm thinking of like Bernie Sanders, and I would imagine he's not very pro-gun, but he lives in a very pro-gun state and probably doesn't vote against stricter gun laws because he would like to stay in office and do the other work that he's interested in.
That is correct. He willingly acknowledges that Vermonters are not with him, and he speaks for Vermont. He doesn't speak for another state, and he votes where Vermonters are on that particular issue, and many others as well. But people totally misunderstand. A legislator, they really don't have a big interest in every single issue. Government is very complicated. There's a lot of things government do, and we could spend an entire podcast going through all the things that government does and what they do that you don't even realize they do. And most people that are elected don't understand all that. You wouldn't find in our 112-member legislature here, you wouldn't find two people that really understand the sexual offender registry. And you say, well, Larry, that's silly. They vote. Yes, they do, because law enforcement told them to. That they told them this is what the other states are doing. This is the model act as recommended by the National Conference of State Legislature, and that this is what we do. But they don't understand the nuances unless they have a family member on it. And so if they lose their office, they can't work on what is important to them. It may be improving foster care. It may be on public transportation. That may be where their heart and soul is. It may be environmental. It may be on any number of things. K through 12 education. It may be on higher ed. I can go on and on with things. It might be that that's what their passion is. And they're not going to sacrifice the opportunity to make a difference on where they care so that they can fight for a constituency that's very unpopular. They're just not going to do that. That's the reality. I don't make the rules. I'm just telling you, as the reality, they're not going to do that. And I know we'll get that YouTube comment or it'll have something bombastic to say about that. But I don't write the rules for our democracy. I'm just relaying to you, that is the reality of people you elect. They're not going to sacrifice their career to fight for something that's so unpopular when that would prevent them from doing what they would really like to work on.
I guess another example, though, is I follow tech very heavily, as most of you would already know. With the Facebook files, the release of the Facebook documents that came out with how their algorithms working and teenage girls on Instagram have terrible images, whatever. And but these are, generally speaking, older humans, and they don't know nearly as much about tech as however much tech is influencing our lives, but they don't know about it. And we you would think that they would have staffers that can do some level of informing them, but that's not what they're there to do. That's not what their forte is. So Rand Paul, if I'm not mistaken, he is an eye doctor. Okay, well, what is he going to know about necessarily how Facebook works and how to regulate it? He would need someone to teach him. It's not what his emphasis and area of expertise is.
So that is correct. He would be very likely to be able to be very helpful on the issues that he understands. But most of the time, you rely on, if you're in the federal Congress, the House or the Senate, they have an excellent amount of staff support. As you get onto the less populated states, they don't have so much staff support. And you end up relying on the bureaucrats that tell you this is what you need to do. If the people that wear the nice insignia and the uniform come in and say this is what we need to do, that is what they're going to vote for, absent a compelling reason not to vote for it.
Okay. Well, Larry, I think we are at the point for where we can do the who's that speaker, I think.
Sure.
I could have that wrong. I don't think I missed anything else. Yes. I'm going to play who's the speaker from last week.
We shall never surrender.
I said it was very short. I don't recall anybody writing in. I didn't think that was going to be that hard to figure out who it was, but nobody wrote in, Larry. So that was who?
That was Sir Winston Churchill when he gave his famous speech that we will fight them in the beaches, we'll fight them in the streets, we'll fight them from the trees, we shall never surrender.
Yeah, I did. I figured if I put in all of that, then it would have just been too easy. But either nobody cared, Larry, or they were stumped by it. And then here we go. Another one of your contemporaries, Larry. Here we go with another one for this week. So this is this week's Who's That Speaker? You can email me at registrymatterscast@gmail.com with your answer. If you announce it in chat, I'm disqualifying you.
A date which will live in infamy. United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire.
Oh, and I cut it off, Larry, because that would be the Empire with like the Death Star and the TIE fighters and the Force. That Empire?
Well, I'm not sure about that. That seems like that was like way, way back. That sounds like a crackly voice. Who could that be?
I don't know. Write into registrymatterscast@gmail.com if you think you have the answer for this week's Who is That Speaker? Larry, we're right at an hour. We can shut it down. We have new patrons to do for sure. Hey, one of the new patrons was in chat and he just left. He doesn't even get to hear his name announced. Anything before we go on to that?
Well, aren't we going to be doing something special and different tonight?
Yes, we are. We do. After we finish this, don't leave. Don't leave if you're there in chat, because we're going to do a Patreon extra where Larry is going to tell us about how the state of the economy is. Right?
What the heck does that have to do with the registry?
It has nothing to do with that. I've said before that we are teasing the idea of starting like a spinoff program where we're going to talk about other policy things that Larry has interest in and expertise in. And this would be something along those lines. Let's cover some new patrons. We had two new patrons this week. We had one named Patrick. Thank you very much, Patrick. And Brandon. Brandon just went away from the chat in live stream chat to go watch a baseball game. Like, who cares about baseball? But thank you both very much for becoming new patrons. If you want to sign up and listen to the Patreon feed, you can put your podcast app in there and get it, and you'll get it tomorrow afternoon when I release it. It comes out usually like before lunch on Sunday. Did we have any new snail mail subscribers, Larry?
Well, I think we may have announced Matthew before, but we received his payment. It was a very large and massive payment for years and years of transcripts to come, but he paid, and I think we have not announced him, but it doesn't matter. Welcome, Matthew. He is in Rochester, Minnesota, as a guest of the BOP.
Wow, guest, huh? Probably not very much of a guest. Probably not really happy that he's there. But that is all we have for this evening. Again, if you go subscribe over at patreon.com for as little as a buck a month, you can listen to any Patreon extra, any extra content that we put out. Oh, and probably, unless something bad happens, us achieving the 100 subscriber goal and me playing a sax solo for you people that will probably be happening next week live on the air. And so that'll be happening next week. So sign up for Patreon and you can participate and hear me squeak and honk and be terrible at a saxophone.
And are you going to be bobbing and bouncing?
There will probably be some gesticulating.
All right. I'm looking forward to that.
Feel free to go over to registrymatters.co and you can find all the show notes. You can find links to everything. You can find links to go over to Patreon. You can sign up for emailing when I release the episode and get notified that way. And you can leave a voicemail over at 747-227-4477. Again, email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, the best way to support the podcast is over at patreon.com/registrymatters. You can find us everywhere on the internet, generally speaking, by going to searching for Registry Matters, whether that's on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, etc., etc. We are all over those places. And without further ado, Larry, I think that is all we have for the evening, and I'll see you on the other side when we do a Patreon extra.
Thanks for having me.
Very well. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.